The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
Now, I was talking there a second ago about Gwyneth Paltrow and her conscious uncoupling, which to the rest of us, I think, kind of means marital breakdown or a relationship coming to an end. And if she can do that with all sweetness and light, good luck to her. I'd say it's uncommon enough because another woman, and for some reason people hate, well, I know maybe they don't, some people hate her for all of that stuff, as they say. But here's a woman that people in general love, and it happens to be Nigella Lawson. And she also features in a lot of the papers today because she's done an interview which will go out on air on Monday on BBC. And while she didn't actually go into the breakdown of her marriage, she did say the breakup was like having a layer of skin removed. So I wouldn't think that was conscious uncoupling. She said, while I'm alive, well, I am alive, I've had better times, life has had its dips and it can get better. And you can get on with it. And she also says she doesn't like to live her life too much in public. And indeed, she just didn't want to go into any information because, needless to say, people wanted to ask her, what was Sachi like? How did it all come about? But she ain't said a word about that yet. She did say she had to stop reading the papers during all that, which she finds difficult because she was a journo, she said. And if, you know, she was addicted to newspapers, but she said if you don't read it, then it doesn't enter your bloodstream and you don't get contaminated, which I would think is kind of mildly sensible. But there you go. Now, referring back to the British ambassador, call was in to say, Dominic is a great ambassador for England. He's also a beautiful speaker. I've met him on a couple of occasions, a really good guy and has a mischievous sense of humour. And on the plane, what I'm wondering is if the new location turns out to be the plane wreckage, what are all the other massive chunks of flotsam that have been seen in lots of other places? Are our oceans polluted beyond belief? Well, I think that's a very important question. And it would seem that the answer to that is yes, that we have thrown endless things into the oceans and they're all flying around there. Well, not flying around, sinking around, I suppose is the word that I'm looking for. But, you know, cargo and stuff and things just over the side. And well, anyway, there is a lot of stuff in the ocean. Now, I'm going to move on to something that I suspect you're all going to find very interesting, particularly any of you with a modest interest in history. And as you know, just at the moment, we're on the run-up to an awful lot of anniversaries, 1914, 1916, 1918, and all of the kind of life-changing things that happened for tens of millions of people right across Europe, but also fundamentally for us on this little green and misty isle. And it's when we look back at this decade for commemoration, it's hard to believe that women in that early period in the 20th century not only couldn't vote, but they found themselves barred from membership of all Irish political and cultural organisations, even if they wanted to go the revolutionary path. Well, I'm joined in studio here in Dublin by two people that are going to talk to us about that, and Margaret Ward, who is in Belfast. And here in Dublin, I have just lost my piece of paper. I've got Kay Sheehy of this house and Anne Matthews, who's also an historian. And as I say, Margaret Ward in Belfast, who has written a book called Maud Gonne's Ireland, Ireland's Joan of Arc, I should say. You're all very, very welcome. Now, we're coming up very close to midday when I'm going to have a break. So what I'm going to ask you to do first, Anne, is just to set the context that I was starting there.
Okay.
Of where women were at the time and what the thinking was and all that. This is the foundation of Cumann na mBan.
Well, in terms of Irish society was still Victorian in its social mores. Across Britain, as in Ireland, single women didn't mix in the company of unmarried or married men. If you think Jane Austen, a woman who was not married, of the respectable classes, middle classes and upwards, was required always to have a chaperone when she went out. So it was very difficult.
You're ordinary folk. Ordinary middle class folk.
Ordinary middle class respectable women did not go out in the streets on their own.
And what about ordinary respectable working class?
Well, they were working class. They worked in factories. It didn't apply to them. They didn't take it on board.
Right.
But it's one of the reasons working class girls were vulnerable. Which is another story. But
right,
what we're looking at here is coming on. And the background to this is simply like when Charlotte Bronte had to go to London, as an example, to meet someone when she was published, she had to find a chaperone to go with her on the train. And that sensibility existed in Ireland right up to 1914. When Cumannamon was founded in the Rotunda, they set up a specific separate ladies' platform, and it was called the ladies' platform for the women, so they wouldn't be mixing in the hall in the company of the men. And for women of the middle classes and upper classes, particularly people like coming from the background of, say, the Countess, marriage was freedom. Marriage represented freedom to them, because once they were married, they could go where they liked and mix with who they liked.
Interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And Edith Somerville, the biography of Edith Somerville, is very, very detailed on that. That up to 40 or 50, you're still needing a chaperone if you're not married.
And to think that we are critical of that when it happens in Islamic countries nowadays.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every time I read all this material, it's like reading how our lives were 100 years ago.
Right.
Yes. And it was very, 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 it was in etiquette.
Was it politics or was it war? What changed it?
Oh, World War One changed it.
World War One.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Apart from coming on, women are entering the British Army. Now, they're not members of the army. They don't have equal membership of the British Army either.
Yeah.
So the volunteers are not unusual in not having women. You're not going to expect a group of conservative middle-class Irishmen to be way ahead of the British counterparts in terms of sensibility and women's rights. So the war and what women contributed to the war, and everything changed. Everything changed after 1918.
Right.
And so the whole social society that was there more or less collapsed and everything changed.
And a little bit of freedom.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And and there's loads within this that's of interest to so many people from so many aspects. And we'll be coming back to that after our break. But now at 12 noon, it's time for the Angelus. Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Now, caller was on already to say Maud Gonne raised the wages of the workers of Erris by 100% by her determined actions, more than any trade union could ever do before or since. And that's from Bob. And just to remind you that we are talking about all those seismic changes that happened 1914, 1916, 1918, what the environment was like the before, what were the causes and after. And I'm going to go to Belfast and to welcome you also, Margaret Ward. And Anne Matthews was just setting, you know, a bit of the context of what kind of society it was here. Can you bring me into something a little bit more specific, but still within that bigger context, on how Cumannamon started?
Well, Cumannamon started because we're at time of the Home Rule crisis, and the North Ulster Volunteer Force has formed. And so in the South, the Nationalists had to show that Nationalist Ireland was also determined to win Home Rule by setting up a militant organisation. So the men set up the National Volunteers in November 1913, and as Anne said, women attended that meeting but were kept separate. It was announced by Owen McNeill, who chaired that there would also be work for women to do. And so there was a period of about 5 months between the formation of the Volunteers and the inaugural meeting of Cumannamon. And during that time, there is discussion as to what is the specific role of women. Do they need to have their own organisation? Could they not just collect funds when the men asked them to do so? Some wanted to have them as part of the volunteer movement, or would they be a separate organisation? And so all of those discussions were taking place. Nancy Wise Power, for example, said the promoters may have had in mind an auxiliary association acting under the general instructions of the volunteers, but actually the women declared themselves to be an independent organisation of women.
Hannah Shee Skeffington was quoted as saying they were slave women or animated collecting boxes.
Well, of course, Hannah, as a suffragette, is arguing for women's right to the vote. And what the suffragettes are saying is, are the volunteers going to include women's citizenship in this new Ireland? Because at this stage, the Ulster Volunteer Force and Sir Edward Carson, for a very brief moment, are saying they would give women the vote in a provisional government in Ulster if Ulster pulls away from Home Rule Ireland. They, in fact, retract on that very quickly. But there is the whole discussion about women and women and citizenship. And so Hannah is saying, well, what is the view? Quite a lot of the prominent volunteers did not support the women's suffrage movement. The Irish Parliamentary Party voted against bills on women's suffrage in the House of Commons. So it was a very real issue. And she felt disappointed that some women that she was very close to didn't extract more from the volunteers before they agreed to come in Amman.
You know, with all this respectability that we're talking about, you know, it sounds like knitting in the corner kind of thing. By the end of all that time, Cumann na mBan was far more revolutionary than Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. I mean, how did they go from one to the other? I remember doing an interview with Sheila Humphreys. And I mean, she thought that De Valera had let the side down completely when he eventually, as she thought, accepted the treaty. She didn't forgive him for it, you know.
Well, yes, a lot of those women, I met Sheila Humphreys, Maura Comerford, Ethna Coyle O'Donnell in the 1970s. They gave me a lot of help with my research at that time. Those were women whose revolutionary flame never dimmed, and always talked about what they called the counter-revolution. And they felt that symbolically, at least in 1916, when De Valera didn't let women into his outpost in Boland's Mill, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, when the constitution is being drawn up in the 1930s, reminds people that the person who's in charge of the constitution about putting women in their primary place within the home is the man who didn't let them fight in the Easter Rising.
Right. Okay, you want to come in there?
Yes, between 1914 and the constitution of 1937, Cumann na mBan had experienced five splits. And the Cumann na mBan, the one that was founded in April 1914, split in August. And every time, and then it split again.
Good Irish tradition.
Yeah, then it split again in 21, then in 25, then in 27, and then in 34. They have a magnificent split in 34. So Sheila Humphreys and Maura Comerford are coming from the later period. But at the women who founded it, in that first, what I call the first Cumann na mBan.
Yeah.
Those women, they saw themselves as a ladies' committee. Their sensibility was ladylike. And while one of the pamphlets said there would be rifle practice, it was down to each branch to decide whether they would or would not have rifle practice. And the only branch who had rifle practice was the one in Belfast. The rest of them didn't do it.
Right.
But also having said that, up to the split in 1914, there was no more than 450 women in the organisation when you're looking at 180,000 men. So small numbers.
Very small,
yeah,
really.
Small numbers. And then it split and then it rebuilt again. And by 1916, you're still talking less than 500 women. So
and
it's small.
The suffrage, yeah. The campaign for suffrage was going on at the same time then.
Yes, it is. But what happened when Cumann na mBan was founded and Hannah Sheehy's criticisms, it caused a rift. Women felt they had to take sides. And it caused a split in some women who were with the suffrage movement. But the Irish Women's Franchise League in 1912 had 12,000 members. In its history, Cumann na mBan never had that membership.
Right.
Never.
Right.
But the Cumann na mBan national split caused a split and a fissure in that.
Right. Kay, you've been sitting there very quietly. You were going over looking at old material. And in 1916... how did they fit into the picture there?
Well, first of all, which reflects or illustrates what Anne was saying, there's a Mary O'Connor. She was a member of Cumann na mBan, and she recalls in an interview she gave to Jim Fahey in 1980 the activities and the training she got involved in as a member of Cumann na mBan.
We were trained in first aid. We were trained to how to break a rifle or a revolver and close it again and how to keep them clean, how to mine them in for dumps. They had to be dumped. They called them dumps, places of security where they could be kept. And once we had grenades in our house. And somebody said the house was going to be raided. And I took the basket of grenades and I carried it around the block of our house, the whole block of houses, until my sister came to tell me where to bring them to for safety. You wouldn't dream of doing away with them or anything. They were too precious. But when I went up for my active service certificate, one of the referees asked me, how did I know whether it was a bomb or a grenade? And I said there were squares on the grenade.
And also there's another clip here, again reflecting what Anne and Margaret said about the auxiliary nature of Cumann na mBan. On Easter Monday, there was a great feeling that the rising or a revolution was imminent. But the women...
they didn't know, did they?
No. So I think some of the citizen army women would have been more au fait with some of the plans. But Cumann na mBan were very much... they were told to turn up for one of these route marches with a day's ration. But they were a bit confused when they got to their meeting point with their other Cumann na mBan members. And here's Leslie Bandabara. She met her fellow Cumann na mBan women up at the Black Church in Dublin. And this is what happened to her.
About 10 o'clock, I got a note to say that I was to report at the Black Church. I was mobilised for there. So I put on my haversack and all the remainder, and I went up there, and all our branch of Cumann na mBan were there, a great number of the members. We were to be attached to Ned Daly's battalion, which was in occupying Church Street and the forecourts. Mm. So we were told to wait until we got some instruction. We waited until about nearly 1 o'clock. I had a great friend, her name was Breathe Dixon. I said, I'm not going home today. So she said, where are you going? Well, we had seen the Lancers go down from the Phoenix Park down Blessington Street, beautifully plumed. You never saw anything like them. You'd think they were going out to receive some royalty. And then we heard firing. And it was that really that made me say, I'm not going home today. So she said, well, we'll go down to the GPO. You see, we had heard it was occupied. So we went down and we went in. And the first people we met were Tom Clark and Sean McDermott. We had known these very well, the two of us. Tom Clark then said to the two of us, you stand by now because I'm going to use the two of you as couriers, you see.
I saw you taking notes there.
Yes, just so I don't lose track.
Yeah. Tell me, yeah.
Okay, can I start with the first one, the arm stump? And I won't say a lot about it, but the reason they learned how to break down guns and keep them clean was when you're storing guns, they have to be put away cleaned, ready for use. So this is the job they had. And there was one woman, I'll just leave it at this, there was one woman in the Broadstone and she kept the arm stump under her bed. You know, they kept them all kinds of places in barns and sheds. And then they would bring them to... she's talking about the War of Independence. Mm-hmm. So, and then they would, when there was an ambush taking place, they would bring the guns to wherever the location was.
Yeah.
And then they would bring them back and then clean them and put them back under the bed.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Kay, I interrupted your flow there.
So then the women finally find, you know, they go, some of them go down to the GPO, some of them find a place in the revolution. And Sheila Grennan is, she was a member of Cumann na mBan. She'd already taken a dispatch up to Dundalk to tell them that the rising was on. And in an interview with Donoghue Dooling, she talked about being in the GPO and Connolly sends her over to the forecourts. And when she's at the forecourts, she meets this woman who challenges her, saying, is that O'Rahilla isn't fighting? So Michael Joseph O'Rahilla was one of the leaders of the volunteers, but he had tried to stop the rising because he thought it was going to fail. But when it started, he said, well, I've wound up the clock, I might as well hear it tick. And he joined the lads down in the GPO. So when Sheila goes up to the forecourts for Connolly, she gets involved in all of this and has to make it clear to the woman that O'Rahilla is actually fighting.
Connolly sent me down to them forecourts. And when I went down to the forecourts, I had a dispatch for Frank Fahey. but I gave it to Joe McGuinness because he was at the railings. There was a woman there at the forecourt, and she was giving no dogs abuse about the O'Reilly. Oh, she called them for everything and anything, and she said that her son was in the forecourt fighting, but O'Reilly wouldn't come out to fight.
Oh, dear.
So I didn't tell you, I put her right. And said she, and you say he's up in the post office. So I said, I know the O'Reilly well, I said. He's up in the post office, I said. I must tell me son, said she. However, I hope she did. But that evening, Connolly came to me and he said to me, he said, well, he said, they obeyed your orders, he said. What orders, said I? The orders you said you gave in the forecourts. I didn't give any orders. Didn't you carry a dispatch telling them to blow up Linen Hall? When I came back from the forecourts, in the course of the day, I must have met the O'Reilly. And I told him this story. Now, are you sure, he said, that you told that woman that you saw me and that you knew me, he said. I did. Yes, I did. Said I. Well, he said, you have done me a great service, he said. I'm very grateful to you. And he said, when we're in occupation here, he said, for a week, we'll have a ball. And he said, I'll dance a minuet with you.
Amazing, when you hear these
we
names.
We didn't last the week at all.
I know, and she's just saying there that sure we didn't last the week at all. Yeah. And O'Reilly was killed in Sackville Street.
Hearing her voice, I've never heard that before, and it makes her more real.
You'd read about her, but you hadn't heard.
Well, I've written about her and read about her so much, and I didn't know that existed. Yeah, the voices. Yeah, it makes her real.
Yeah, but it's just the casualness of all these names, like what Connolly said and O'Reilly said. Yeah. Dancing a minuet is not what I would have thought would be the dance of choice. I don't know why. Anyway, let's go on to the next one, Kay.
This then is, I know that both Anne and Margaret have a lot to say about Countess Markievicz and her role in The Rising. And this is just a clip. Margaret Skinner was a member of Glasgow Cumann na mBan, but she was also attached to the Citizen Army. And this is her account of meeting Countess Markievicz during The Rising.
Right.
That evening, just when it was beginning to grow dusk, on my way back from the GPO, I noticed a crowd of curious civilians who had been hanging around the green all day had disappeared. The next thing I saw was two persons hurrying away from the green. These were Madame Markievicz and William Partridge. They stopped just ahead of me. When I saw the British soldiers coming down, Harcourt Street. The Countess stood motionless, waiting for them to come near. She was a lieutenant in the Irish Citizen Army, and in her uniform and black hat with great plumes looked the most impressive. At length she raised her gun to her shoulder. It was an automatic which she had converted into a rifle and took aim. The shots rang out and I saw the two officers leading the column drop to the streets. As the Countess was taking aim again, the soldiers, without firing a shot, turned and retreated in great confusion.
Right, that's our version of it. Can I go back up to you, Margaret, because you're at a remove from us, so feel free to chip in. I suppose the best known female names really are Maud Gonne and Countess Markievicz. Personally, I love hearing about so-called ordinary participants as well. Where do you place her?
I'd just like to comment first of all on Margaret Skinner again. It sounds like it's wonderful to hear her voice and that Scottish accent, you know, because she has come over from Glasgow to take part in the Rising, and she's shot and badly wounded during the Rising. She's one of the few women, other than Markievicz, who also takes a military role. She's partly first aid, but she then takes that off and puts on her Citizen Army uniform when she's taking that military role. She saw the two distinct roles that people could play in the Rising. And, you know, when she applied for a pension, she was informed that her application couldn't be considered because the definition of wound in the Pension Act only contemplated the masculine gender. So people didn't expect women to take that kind of role. And in Belfast, as Anne had said, women were not only learning to clean rifles, but Elizabeth Corr said we were just about to practice at moving targets when the Easter week came. So they had obviously seen that they could have taken part in the rising on equal terms with men, because Connolly's two daughters were also in the Belfast branch of Cumann na Mban.
And Markovic?
Well, Countess Markovic was, I mean, like other women in the Citizen Army, Helena Maloney and Kathleen Lynn, found that egalitarianism, I think, more congenial at that time to Cumann na Mban. And they were accepted on equal terms with the men. Markovic talked about the kind of route marches they had to go on. She said that Connolly, as a convinced feminist, promoted women to the rank and position that they were suited for.
What's your own take on it?
Well, at the moment, I'm coming to the tail end of writing the history of the Irish Citizen Army. And one of the discoveries I made in the last 18 months, which left me totally breathless, is that Countess Markovic was the only female member of the Irish Citizen Army. That the women involved in the Citizen Army were a distinct women's section, just as an auxiliary, just as Cumann na Mban were. And Connolly was the man responsible for creating this.
For creating
the women's section, Citizen
right.
Army. But there were no women in the Citizen Army apart from the Countess. She's the only one logged in the roll book as a member. And then in 1915, a year after Cumann na Mban was founded, James Connolly founded the women's section, Irish Citizen Army. And the person in charge of the women's section was Dr. Kathleen Lynn. Now, this is new research.
Right.
And it will be in my book coming out soon. Now, can I say about Skinnader? The uniform she had was what she called a moleskill uniform, moleskin she had made, and she says the Countess paid for it. Now, she wrote this account in 1917, and she was in the States, and it's in the form of hero worship. And I think she, in her book, she is Sancho Panza to Countess Markovic's Don Quixote. And that's how I see her. And it's coming from
that's
research. It's
one.
Not just I'm not just making this up. And she while she attached herself to the Stephen's Green garrison, she was not a member of the Citizen Army. She was a member of Cumann na Mban. But she attached herself. She was injured. And there's a debate about how she got injured in some of the statements, how she got injured. But there is no... I've trawled through all the accounts of soldiers who were shot in Dublin, and there were no soldiers shot at the bottom of Harcourt Street. And I think Margaret Skinnader was covering up for the fact that she killed the policeman. I think that's what she's doing in that book, because she wrote that in the book in 1917. So she couldn't... And I think
She wouldn't want to incriminate herself.
Yes,
yeah.
And it may be a cover-up. But there was no soldiers shot at the bottom of Harcourt Street, and a professional soldier would not walk towards a woman in uniform holding a gun like that.
Wouldn't?
No, they were trained soldiers. They were professional soldiers.
Yeah, but if she was behaving like a soldier as well.
Well, to put it this way, I'm very familiar with soldiers. Okay, I was married to one. And she did not look military in any sense.
Right.
And she's holding, you know, no, they would not. No soldier in any kind of training. And these guys have been in France for 2 years are going to walk towards somebody holding a sawn-off Mauser. They're not going to do it. But aside from all of that, that's speculation. The factual thing is there were no soldiers killed in uniform or otherwise at the bottom of Harcourt Street.
But I think that in terms of the Citizen Army, whether or not women are in a separate section, I think what's important is women felt included. Women were mobilised alongside the men in the Citizen Army. Women went out with the men in the Citizen Army. So they didn't feel a distinction in their roles in that sense. You know, there might may have been a technical thing about whether they were a separate section, but when you saw them together, they were together. I think that's very important to also include.
Well, Emily Norgrove, who wrote about, she was in City Hall, and she writes very clearly about the women's section, and they knew exactly what the role was, which was to make tea, sandwiches, be a support, first aid, all of that. That's what they did. And she's very clear in her consciousness that that's what she was doing.
I don't know which one I read said that he regretted that he hadn't allowed the women in because it meant that the men had to do the cooking.
That was De Valera said that.
Probably. Oh, God bless him. Right, well, that clarifies what happened subsequently, I suppose, in the Constitution.
Indeed, that's absolutely the case.
Can I come back to Morgan? I mean, she was away for 1914-18. Some people suggest that the two kind of so-called upper class women, to a certain extent, were not playing at things, but that kind of they were more important themselves than the larger issues. What do you think, Margaret?
Well, obviously, they are flamboyant women. They are unusual women, and it's not surprising that they get that kind of attention. They're also, a lot of the women in their memories of, say, of Countess Markievicz will talk about her eccentricities, and the ordinary rank and file common Oman woman would say, but I was used to her eccentricities. Despite that, they, you know, they admired what she did and what she gave up and the fact she put all her money towards the movement. It wasn't that they were simply playing a role and then going back to comfortable lives, leaving everybody else. I mean, Markievicz's home became almost a commune, that people were there. Her stepson talks about how awful it was for him to live there. They never had, you know, on Christmas Day, they had black pudding or something to eat. It wasn't a... She didn't make a domestic environment for him. That it wasn't her kind of interests.
You don't go along with all of that, Anne.
Well, I think the what has happened subsequently, my take, if you like, on Countess, people often say to me, you don't like the Countess, don't like what's gone. I have absolutely no feelings about them whatsoever. What I deal with is the iconography, what has been created when you talk about women and the revolution. The two names pop up all the time, as though there is nobody else involved. And that's down to the iconography that was created subsequently, not down to the two women. So it's not, I don't have an issue with the women, I have an issue with the iconography. But the other thing is that Countess Markievicz did not give all her money away. She, when her father died, she was left an income of £150 a year.
Which was a lot of money.
£150 a year was not a lot of money.
Was it not?
That was not enough money to keep a servant.
Right, when you put it that way.
Maud Gonne had about 350 a year, yes.
Maud Gonne had 300.
Had about 350 a year, yeah. So she had 150 a year, which was not enough to keep a servant. And when she married the Count after her father's death, and he left her the money. And when she married him, he also was an artist living on his wits, and they did not have money. She did not give anything away because she had nothing to give away. Now, she paid some of the rent for the Vina Boys in Camden Street. And that was probably 10 shillings a week or something.
Didn't she buy coal and stuff for people living in the tenements?
Sorry?
Didn't she not buy coal and stuff for people in the tenements?
This was much later in the 20s. She worked for the poor until the ends of her life. I think the fact that she had an absolutely enormous funeral says a lot about how her life touched those of the Dublin working class. Despite the kinds of iconography about her, I think that what history shows is that she was an important woman in her own right. And that is one of the reasons why she has been written about.
Okay.
Anne?
Okay. What history shows is the people who wrote the iconography. That's what that's about.
No, what history shows is that she
no,
had
No, history
a
is
huge,
written by historians.
No, I'm talking about the actual events that took place, which was an enormous funeral of genuine sorrow when she died.
Okay. There are estimates that 150,000 people, Dublin had a population of about 300,000-ish at the time. There are estimates that 150,000 people turned out for her funeral. The same amount of people turned out for Michael Collins' funeral, the same amount of people turned out for Arthur Griffith's funeral.
Yes, but
and I grew up, no,
yes,
can I finish,
and
please?
And they're huge.
No, can I finish, please? When somebody, now we see famous people on television all the time. At that time, a funeral was like street theatre. I grew up in Dublin. The funerals of the great and the good were sheer street theatre.
Yeah, but it took to match the funeral.
The same amount of people. The same amount of people turned up.
Michael Collins and stuff is pretty.
Oh yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, what's being put out there. Well, what I'm reading, what Margaret's saying is, all these people turned up, especially for her, but they turned up for the others as well. And it's part of, you go to see the person laid out in the coffin because then you can say you saw them. You don't know what. Nobody knew. People didn't know what she looked like. Only people in around her, because. Now we know what people look like, television, radio, newspaper, the whole lot. People don't know. But people turned up for the funerals, and you would have thousands of people turning up for a funeral, and it was a day out, and it was street theatre.
But I think if you take that, you'd be saying all funerals were large. All funerals were not large.
No, I'm talking about the famous. This was
specific. You know, some of them were certainly saying something about the person a little bit more than just that the populace was curious.
Yes, and what I'm saying, yes, and that applies to Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith, because the same amount of people turned up. That's what I'm saying. Thomas Ashe, the town was crammed with people, 1917, with people, and it becomes part of street theatre, part of ceremony, part of respect. But she didn't stand out,
right?
Because the others got the same respect.
But the others died during a time of intense political conflict. Thomas Ashe died after hunger striking. Constance Markievicz died a lot after that time. She died when there wasn't that same political ferment.
It was. She died in 27. Well, yes. Just 2 weeks before Fianna Fáil went into Dáil Éireann.
But this is after the War of Independence, after the Civil War, as the state is starting to form.
Yes,
it is not
the
same time
of Dublin are living with the trauma.
Political context.
Listen,
this is just fascinating stuff, I have to say. And I think that the commemorating that will be going on over the next while will be a source of great interest to many people. Now, I should say that if you're interested in this, the history show on RT Radio 1 on Sunday at 6 o'clock will also be discussing Comhain na mBan. And a reminder that Margaret Ward, that her book is Maud Gonne Ireland's Joan of Arc, and I presume there'll be arguments about her too, but not... Pardon?
I didn't mention my book.
Off you go and you mention it.
My book is called... I have two books. One is called Renegades, Irish Republican Women, 1900 to 1922. And the part two of it is Irish Republican Women, called Dissidents, 1922 to 41.
Okay.
Marion, could I just say that...
Sure.
I also wrote a book on women and Irish nationalism called Unmanageable Revolutionaries that first came out in 1983. And I've written a biography of Hannah Sheehy Skeffington.
Well, listen.
No, can there I just,
the, all of these books are just going to be...
Yeah, no, can I please say about Margaret's book, though?
Very briefly.
It's important. It's really important. It's really important. Margaret published that book. Nobody cared about Comhain na mBan. And Margaret, when she published that book in 1984, she was the first one to do it.
Right.
And she brought them to our consciousness.
Right.
Yeah.
OK, listen, we're going to have to leave it there, way over time. But it's all so interesting. Casey, thank you very much. Anne Matthews and Margaret Ward, thank to you both. And we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.